Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world. Online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Not to get all Ben Bernanke on you here, but have you ever wondered why inflation's been fairly tame for so long? Part of the answer is Mr. Bernanke's interest rates, yes. The other part, though, is this thing called pricing power. Companies couldn't raise prices because consumers wouldn't pay them. But today, the country's biggest chemical company said it's fed up and it's not going to take it anymore. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity. Online at us.areva.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today. This one is the 28th of May, and it's great to have you here. The company in question is Dow Chemical, and in all fairness, it's waited way longer than others have to raise prices. But today, Dow said effective this weekend, prices for all 3,200 of its products are going to go up by as much as 20%. Even if you couldn't recognize many of those products, you'll recognize the culprit right away, as Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
Dow Chemical says this across-the-board price hike is unparalleled in its 111-year history. Frank Mitch is a senior chemical analyst at BB&T Capital Markets. He says chemical companies once gave wholesale customers 90 days' notice before raising prices. Today's hike hits in just 4 days.
This is an unprecedented move by them to announce it pretty much across the board, really to signal to their customer base that it's no longer business as usual. They really need to get prices up ASAP.
Like everyone else, Dow has been hit by high energy and transportation prices. And petroleum products are a key ingredient in much of what Dow makes, things like styrofoam, pesticides, and plastics. Dow says its hydrocarbon spending has quadrupled in just 6 years, to a projected $32 billion this year. Those costs now make up half of its total spending.
We have seen bits and pieces of these type of announcements from other companies, but obviously you're talking about the 800-pound gorilla here with Dow. So yes, I do expect to see other chemical producers announce price increases as well.
And you know what that means?
It's inevitable that inflation will increase for a time when energy prices have jumped as much as they have.
That's economist Peter Morisi with the University of Maryland. To cut costs, Dow laid off 1,000 workers in December and is moving its commodity chemical production to Asia and the Middle East, where raw materials are cheaper. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
On the topic of energy and the bottom line, oil jumped a bit today, just over $131 a barrel at the close. But there are all the same some hopes for a break in those bubbling crude prices. At one point this morning, the price started with the number 125, about 10 bucks under the record set last week. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson is on the oil story today. Jeremy, how are you?
Pretty good, Kai. How about you?
I'm all right, thanks. So have we come now at long, long last to the tipping point in the price of oil?
Probably not. Most of the people I spoke with today said the fundamentals are not changed, the supply and demand. Now, demand here in the U.S. may actually drop this year by about 1%. That would be the first drop since 1991. But there are a lot of countries around the world that have subsidies for gas. Places in the Middle East, in China, that means it's still just about as cheap there as it was. So people are still buying gas like they used to. Also, it's hard for us to measure demand, and it's even harder for us to measure supply. Nobody really knows what the world supply of oil is. I spoke earlier today with a guy named Paul Roberts, who wrote a book called The End of Oil.
The market's so complex, and it lacks transparency to such a degree that it's really hard to say what exactly we're in the middle of right now. And that's what's so scary, because you can't plan. You can't plan ahead.
Now, what Roberts says many speculators are betting is that supply is not rising as fast as demand, and that's why that price keeps going up.
All right. Well, here's the big question, though. Is it just a hiccup, and will the price continue to rise, or is there some kind of downward trend that we can anticipate?
Well, analysts are split on that. One guy I spoke with today said that price, $135 a barrel that we saw last week, was so ridiculously high that the market was just correcting, a long overdue correction, and that it probably will stay down. Others say not so fast. It's supply and demand. Those fundamentals are staying the same. Industry costs are rising. And in addition to that, there's a lot more state control of oil than there used to be. All those fundamentals keep that price going up.
It's a global market, Jeremy, for oil, right? So I have to ask about external factors other than supply and demand. What about, the dollar, for instance?
Well, that definitely plays into it. I mean, we've all heard about speculation in the oil markets. And if the value of a dollar is weakening, why would you want to buy it? You go for something that's going up, like perhaps oil. The other part of it is oil is bought and sold in dollars. And one analyst told me today, if the dollar were even with the euro right now, we wouldn't be looking at a $130 barrel of oil. We'd be looking at $80 a barrel of oil. So that weakening dollar is having an effect on the price that we see here in the United States.
We know there's no direct correlation between the price of a barrel of oil and the price of a gallon of gas, except it always seems to us on the upside. But what about the recent hiccup or the recent downdraft that we've seen the past couple of days? Are we going to see that at the pump anytime soon?
Well, it's funny, Kai. One analyst told me today, when the price of a barrel of oil goes up, you see that price reflected almost immediately sometimes in a gallon of gas. When it goes down, it takes a lot longer if it happens at all. The bottom line is it probably will not affect the price of gas. The gas prices are going to keep going up. And as long as people keep driving and they've still got to drive to work, even for $3.94 a gallon, which is the national average, the price is probably still going to keep going up.
Yeah, $3.94, I wish, right? I paid $4.05 on the way in this morning. What are you guys paying in Washington?
It's about $4 a gallon here in D.C.
Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson in Washington, D.C. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thanks, Kai.
There are more oil stories today than you can shake a stick at. We'll run through just a couple of them here for you. OPEC's going to be smaller come the beginning of next year. Indonesia announced today it's pulling out of the cartel. The country's energy minister said declining production and, ironically enough, the high price of crude led to the decision. Last week, Indonesia was forced to cut its substantial retail gasoline subsidies. ExxonMobil had its annual meeting today down in Dallas. The world's largest publicly traded oil company had a slew of shareholder resolutions on the agenda. Yesterday, we told you about one of them. Descendants of founder John D. Rockefeller want to separate the chairman and CEO jobs. Well, Mr. Rockefeller can rest in peace, and current CEO Rex Tillerson can keep on wearing two hats. That resolution and all the others up for a vote today, there were 17 of them, didn't get anywhere close to enough votes to pass. One last item on the oil beat, although this one's only tangentially related. The Detroit News is reporting that Ford's looking to cut another 12% of its workforce. That'd be about 2,000 jobs in all. Ford's in the middle of a big restructuring program. The company's hoping we'll get it back in the black real, real soon. It's beginning to look like Hollywood might not have to live through another strike, by which, of course, we mean television audiences won't have their favorite series interrupted again. Today, film and TV actors move closer to a deal that could resolve some of the sticky issues that drove writers to the picket lines. One of two actors' unions, the smaller American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, or AFTRA, has reached a tentative agreement with producers, which means a deal between producers and the Screen Actors Guild may be on the way, may being the operative word there, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
The AFTRA deal would mean union members get paid more when their work is streamed or downloaded off the internet, but it won't earn them higher fees from DVDs. Writers and directors' unions couldn't secure those gains either. But the Screen Actors Guild, or SAG, says it will continue to push for more DVD residuals. That could be harder in the wake of the AFTRA agreement.
This is a deal that really takes the wind out of the sails to some degree of the SAG negotiations.
That's media analyst Hal Vogel with Vogel Capital Management.
Why, you could argue, should SAG have a different settlement than AFTRA if they're really pretty much the same type of situations?
No one in the entertainment industry wants a repeat of the writer's strike, which shut down production for 100 days and racked up more than $1 billion in lost revenues. For actors, the sticking point might not even be financial. Take the use of clips from TV shows and movies.
The money was never the issue.
Michael Spire is executive editor of Daily Variety. He says actors want to decide how and where their clips are used.
So the actors want to keep control of that. And the studios claim, hey, it's our product, just as if it's shoes or hamburgers. We can do with it what we want, and we want to control it.
SAG negotiators return to the bargaining table today. The union has until the end of June before its contract expires. AFTRA's tentative deal still needs to be approved by union members. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
It wasn't exactly a storybook ending today on Wall Street, but it wasn't bad either. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've brought you I don't know how many stories over the past couple of months about commodities prices, everything from oil to rice to uranium, and how everything is getting more expensive. Those rising prices have put the squeeze on consumers all over the world. They've also given investors a ton of buying opportunities. But as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports, not all commodities are as good as gold.
To get started, we're going to have a bit of a quiz. Don't worry, it's easy.
Okay. So, little Miss Muffet sat on her tuffet eating her curds and...
whey.
What is whey?
It's like some kind of oatmeal, right? Is it like wheat? I don't know.
Well, it's not wheat. It's what's left over after you turn milk into cheese. Phil Plard follows the market for this stuff at Blimlin Associates.
Not so many years ago, was basically treated as a waste product. It was spread on fields.
But whey is high in protein, low in fat, and today it's found in all sorts of processed foods, from nacho chips to power bars to baby formula. It's also a key ingredient in animal feed, especially for pigs. In 2007 alone, the price of whey almost quadrupled.
Like any good commodity stories these days, I mean, China, you know, plays a role in this marketplace. There are a lot of little pigs in China.
And those little piggies need their protein. Suddenly, last year, what had been a waste product was being exported by the boatload. As prices rose, speculators scrambled for a slice, turning whey into a $2 billion business. Bob Yonkers is the chief economist at the International Dairy Foods Association. He says the sudden price rise sowed the seeds of the market's collapse.
When prices get very high, people start looking for substitute protein sources, and I think that's exactly what happened.
Today, the price of whey has fallen by more than 60%. And like Little Miss Muffet scared by a spider, that's frightened investors away, at least for now. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
This is going to come as a shock to all you type A personalities out there. But all that control you think you have over your lives? Yeah, not so much. You can analyze and plan all you want, and maybe you can nibble away at the margins of whether your investments are going to win or lose, or whether you'll get the promotion you think you so richly deserve. But a new book from Caltech physicist Leonard Mlodinow says many things come down to a disturbing degree of chance. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
No pressure, but I'm going to start by splitting a hair here. You ready?
Okay.
Title of this book is The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives. I thought the thing about randomness was that it was random. There were no rules.
It is random, and it means that there are no patterns, but there are plenty of rules.
Give me a for instance.
Well, one of the rules of randomness is that rare things can happen. So even if something's unlikely to happen, if you keep trying long enough, it will eventually happen.
Like picking stocks.
Like picking stocks. And in the book, I talk about a fellow named Bill Miller who ran a mutual fund, runs a mutual fund company, and was very successful and beat the Standard & Poor's for 15 years in a row. And there were a lot of articles written about what a great feat that was and how unlikely that was. But if you look at the rules of randomness, you'll know that unlikely things will eventually happen.
One of the funny things about that, actually, is that one of the things you're taught when you're thinking about the stock market is prior performance is no indicator of future expectations, right?
Yeah. And moreover, current performance is not necessarily an indication of the underlying ability of someone. Mm-hmm. For instance, if you take a sports example, if you look at the World Series or the NBA championships and two teams are going head-to-head, and usually they do a seven-game series. Suppose that one team was better than the other. Say 55% of the time you'd expect them to win. They have a 55-45 advantage. If they have a 55-45 advantage, mathematics tells you that the lesser team in this case will win a seven-game series 40% of the time. So it's almost like flipping a coin. The series doesn't really tell you much.
We want, it seems to me, precision. We want to know why something happened with a fair degree of certainty. But you talk a lot in this book about, well, it's about this, or it's going to be around that, or the law of probability says it should be this. I mean, there's a certain degree of not knowing that you just have to accept, isn't there?
That's right. When there's uncertainty involved or randomness involved in something, then you can't say exactly what's going to happen. And that's hard for people to accept, and that's why people sometimes make errors in judgment.
Errors in judgment that can, frankly, be expensive if you know, you're in the stock market or if you're investing in a 401k or whatever.
They certainly can be. I've made them myself.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, let me ask you about that. I mean, when you, who now is a student of the laws of randomness, when you sit down and allocate your 401k, what do you do?
Before I wrote this book,
yeah,
I'd look at the past 5 years and see who did well. And the problem is that when you do that, you pay money, as opposed to, say, buying an index fund, you're paying money for that expertise. But now that I've written the book and read the book, I don't do that anymore.
I came away from this book thinking a little bit that no matter how hard you try, there are some things you just need to get over that are going to happen whether you control them or not.
Well, I think one of the lessons of the book is that if you see yourself have a failure or other people have a failure, don't think that they are a failure. Don't think that you are a failure. As an author, I know that you can write the greatest manuscript like Harry Potter and have it rejected 9 times, as that was, and that doesn't mean anything about the book. What you have to always keep in mind is that both success and failure are a combination of your internal qualities and a lot of other things that can happen around you.
Leonard Mlodinow teaches at Caltech. His newest book is called The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives. Leonard, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Coming up, why would someone pay to make a film about himself?
That one day in the future, they know a little about their grandfather, what he done and what was his legacy in the past.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average picked up a third of 1% today, 45 points to close at 12,594. The NASDAQ tacked on 0.2%, 5 points to close at 2486. The S&P 500 grew 0.4%, also 5 points, ended the day at 1390. American International Group, you might know it as AIG, stumbled 4.2% today. A Citigroup analyst said the world's largest insurance company needs even more cash. That's after the $20 billion it raised last week. Sprint Nextel dialed up 4.3% today after analysts raised forecasts for the telecom giant. Quest Communications connected for about 2.5%. AT&T rang up 1.75% today. Ralph Lauren looked sharp today. Shares galloped up almost 12%. That after the apparel company posted strong fourth quarter sales. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.01%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. And by Gather.com, where friends can stay in touch. People are talking at Gather.com. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department releases the first quarter gross domestic product report. The National Space Society discusses the latest out-of-this-world projects at its annual International Space Development Conference in Washington, D.C. And it's the International Day of United Nations Peacekeepers. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Whether oil prices are going to go up or down is one of those random things we can't really know until it happens. Anybody who tells you otherwise is probably trying to sell you something.
But even after you factor out supply, demand, and the dollar, there's a lot of speculation out there that speculation might be driving the run-up in crude. Commentator David Frum thinks that might not be far from the truth.
Maybe it takes a speculator to recognize a speculative bubble. Over the weekend, George Soros gave an interview to the Daily Telegraph in which he described today's oil prices as a bubble, ready to pop. Most analysts poo-poo the role of speculation in today's oil market, but some new evidence suggests that Soros may well be right. My American Enterprise Institute colleague Desmond Lockman observes that institutional investors own and hold more than $250 billion worth of oil today, up from virtually zero half a dozen years ago. If these positions were ever unwound, they could exert an abrupt downward jolt to the price of oil. Here's how it could happen. Imagine that you are a speculator. You own a bunch of oil you bought at prices ranging from $75 to $125 a barrel. You are hoping that the price will go to $200. But nothing lasts forever. Already, Americans are driving less and switching to more efficient cars. A recession in the United States would slash Chinese export earnings and slow the growth of the Chinese automobile market. As the U.S. and Chinese economies weaken and oil consumption dips, the price of oil begins to soften. It drops back below $125, then $120, then $115. As a speculator, you've lost money on your last purchases. Yet you could still score a huge profit on the earlier ones if you act fast. But uh-oh, your competitors have the same idea. You all rush for the exits at once, and after a year of frenzy on the buy side, it's pandemonium on the sell side. It's happened before. Between December 1985 and July 1986, the price of OPEC oil plunged by more than half, from $23.29 to under $10. They still remember the shock in Texas. I wonder if they remember it at the trading desks in London, New York, and Hong Kong.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His latest book is called Comeback: Conservatism That Can Win Again. Send us your thoughts. Online is best for us. Our homepage is marketplace.org. As we mentioned up at the beginning of the broadcast, peace seems to be breaking out in the Hollywood labor wars. This time it was producers and one of the actors' unions. Last time, as you know, it was the writers. But there is a way to avoid all those messy negotiations and still get your name up in lights. No haggling over contracts or back-end deals. No difficult discussions about who gets what from DVD sales or internet rights. Cash Peters reports now from the set of a new movie about him.
This began as such a simple idea. Documentary maker Catherine Gray.
Most people have an interesting story. If you live long enough, you know, you've had ups and downs and twists and turns. And so that was one reason that I created Legacy Flicks. And the other was...
Yeah, it's okay. One's enough. She wanted everybody, basically, to be able to tell their story.
At Legacy Flicks, we provide a top-quality product to preserve your life story.
What they do is they come to your home and film a lavish widescreen tribute to possibly the most interesting person you've ever met. You.
We put it together in a professional manner. We really do it top-notch.
What's to stop it, though, becoming incredibly gooey and saccharine?
It's not all my children, Cash.
No, but it could be. You know, soft focus, tinkly music. Yeah, like that. Carmel Levy is a successful businessman. He sold the very first miniskirt in London in the 60s, so naturally he leapt at the chance of making Carmel the movie.
I wanted to have something for the next generation of my family that one day in the future they know a little about their grandfather, what he done and what was his legacy in the past.
Carmel Levy has led a life full of ups and downs, but he has always persevered with his strong sense of positive thoughts, energy, kindness, and love.
And love. Isn't that great? Like being interviewed on 60 Minutes, only with none of those pesky journalistic checks and balances. Everything you've done seems monumental and prestigious. Jerry Ford runs their New York office.
It is a documentary style that I can leave behind for my son. And often it is revealing that my son doesn't know anything about it, that my
spouse... Oh, and by the way, I'm a woman.
Yeah, you're so horrible.
It's really preserving what you are and what you've done. It might be a short production, but if it's only 30 seconds, then so be it.
My 30-second legacy. What a pathetic individual am I?
That's Bill Beckett, their CEO, and he makes a good point. Surely only about 10 people in every 100 are worth making films about anyway, if that.
Yeah, well, we're seeking out those 10 people. So, you know, like...
So, but what happens if the others come to you?
Well, I guess we'd have to tell them to go get a life, you know?
Would you turn them away? Would you actually open the door and say, please leave, you're very, very boring?
Boy, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
No, I do. You shut up and you take the money. Though, preserving your legacy for all time doesn't come cheap. You'll pay around $3,500 for a 5-minute film, and that's if you're dull. For 30 minutes, it's about 20 grand. Some of their clients even make stuff up, according to Jerry.
People do that. You can make it up, actually. Well, you could. But, you know,
that's my plan.
It is your legacy. It's what you are leaving behind.
So I could just leave a whole bunch of lies.
Absolutely.
Perfect. So when Catherine came to interview me for my own legacy flick, I thought, where do I start? Should I tell her about my prestigious career at NASA? Or my part in the fall of the Berlin Wall? So many memories.
Cash, I understand that you have a pretty amazing story. So tell us how you got to the U.S.
I just took all my belongings to a field, and I set fire to them, and I set off for America.
After giving up all of his worldly possessions, Cash Peters left Manchester, England 11 years ago and ventured to the U.S. to pursue the American dream.
If you're going to invest in something, I think your life story and your legacy is certainly worth an investment.
What legacy do we want to leave behind that is everything?
I want to leave them wondering.
Wondering?
Yeah. How did I escape jail time?
Yeah, how did he do it?
Was that a toupee?
Yeah.
With a name like Cash, he thought anything was possible.
Oh, now you're just being ridiculous. In West Hollywood, California, I'm
Cash Peters
for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
These final notes before we go. First, on the topic of energy prices, let me note that corn dropped a nickel today, down under $6 a bushel. Not that that's supposed to mean anything by itself. But I mention it because of what happened in the Canadian Parliament this afternoon. The House of Commons passed a bill requiring 5% ethanol in all gasoline sold there starting in 2010. Critics down here have blamed U.S. ethanol policy in part for rising food prices. Also this item, David Samble's out of a job. Samble's the COO of Countrywide, the troubled mortgage company that's in the process of being bought out by Bank of America. A couple of months ago, B of A announced it was keeping Samble on to run its new combined mortgage division and that it would pay him $28 million for his troubles. Well, today Samble reconsidered, said he's retiring. B of A confirms, though, that he gets to keep the $28 million. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gobbled up 45 points, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ packed on 5 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 gained 5 points. That's about 0.4% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, authors publish, and then they dream of getting paid.
I went to bed. It was hard for me to sleep. I was thinking I was going to be rich the next day. And, you know, I soon learned that patience is the key here.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that one tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.